Welcome, everyone. My name is Arzuma Sini, and it's a great pleasure welcoming tonight's renowned guests, architects Elizabeth Diller, Ricardo Scofidio, and Charles Renfro, and Columbia University's Professor of Architectural History, Barry Bergdahl, who's also the Chief Curator of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. We are here tonight to celebrate the publication of Lincoln Center Inside Out with a discussion and book signing. This extraordinary new monograph, comprised entirely of eight folds and conceived as a cross between an art book, a scholarly record, and an architectural diary, is the first comprehensive book to feature Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro's innovative strategies for the extensive redevelopment of Lincoln Center into a porous and democratic complex. The book also sets a new standard for presenting contemporary architectural transformations in book form. The recipients of prestigious awards, including the MacArthur Foundation Genius Fellowship, for their commitment to integrate architecture with issues of contemporary culture. The studio's international body of work also includes New York City's Highline, Boston's Institute of Contemporary Art, and Blur for the Swiss Expo. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Architectural Explorations in Books series event, delving into the critical role that architecture publications play in the understanding of contemporary urban developments and structures. Copies of the book are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of the program. Also inviting all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can openly browse one of the largest and most comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of architecture and urban design. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Are you going to read off with your PowerPoint or something?
Okay, do I do that first? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I am going to flip through some slides very, very quickly of our project, and then we'll launch into a conversation. And I would just say one thing I just want to acknowledge for us, Jesse, who's sitting here, who is largely responsible for the design of that book with our team. And we see the book and the project as two really equal projects. So just a couple of words about the architecture. These are the ghosts around the project, all this very big testosterone team. And this is the way we like to remember Lincoln Center. This is what we associate with it. But in fact, this archival image was when we got there much more like this. It was filled with kind of service functions. It was very solid, turned its back on the neighborhood, and is a kind of an accumulation of many logics, and a lot of them came from 50s planning. The project encompassed lots of different parts of Lincoln Center site, and the project was done not as a master plan, but as a kind of agglutination of pieces as the appetite of Lincoln Center grew to transform. And a lot of that stuff is actually not very even visible. Some of it is in the central mechanical plant, where a lot of the money got trapped to really make Lincoln Center function better. These are some before and afters at the interface of Columbus Avenue, before and after, a much more gracious and actually monumental entrance, but monumental on our terms. The stair, while it's widened, is also dematerialized with LEDs and information about what's happening inside. There is a general consciousness about breaking down the surfaces and the edges in the plinth to make Lincoln Center much more public and enable public events to really happen and enable culture to happen in the public spaces. This is a before and after on the fountain. Some of it for us was a much lighter touch here. We went with initial planning of the radial fountain, but we changed some things. We tweaked things. We changed out the waterworks. We changed the dam of water. Changed the seating. Lincoln Center is used in a whole variety of different ways for culture and also for commerce. This is Fashion Week, and we designed the entrance to Fashion Week the first year it was there. This is before and after on North Plaza from a different point of view. We tried to make the space, again, much more public, double use a lot of surfaces, like a big public open space that was also the roof of the destination restaurant. So the public green was converged, which was Juilliard's desire to have something like that. And looking at the restaurant below, so we were involved in most of the work, although Hugh Hardy did a piece of the work and David Rockwell did a piece of the work, and Chen and Williams did a piece of the work. A lot of the initiatives that we took are now engage public events. So there's a kind of many stages of its kind of use. This is the original Canalato building, and we expanded Juilliard by about 55,000 square feet, and also enlarged the lobby for Tully Hall, and made a kind of proper interface throughout. This is the Broadway facade, and looking down from the donor salon at the public space, you can see that there's a huge desire for kind of symmetry across public and semi-public space. And we made everywhere we had a chance to turn Lincoln Center inside out, to make the spaces truly public and accessible, even if you didn't have the couple of hundred dollars that it took to get into an event inside the halls. Before and after, inside of Tully Hall, this was our first concert hall, and some details. This was actually not the original entrance to Juilliard, but this was at some point in time. The entrance in a renovation went from 66th Street to 65th Street, up at Plaza level, one of the great conservatories in the country, without an entrance. We transformed that, gave them a 65th Street entrance, and did a lot of the facilities work inside of the building, orchestra rehearsal, studio black box theater, dance rehearsal. This was a transformation of School of American Ballet's studios, and we had to, in this case, find more space than was actually there. So we found spaces in the plenum to double up the studios. So this is case in point, where two studios are in the place of one. And I think this is kind of... And I wanted to leave with this, which is a kind of complexity diagram. Of course, anyone involved in Lincoln Center will put themselves in the center of it all, but here are we in the center. And our work was in collaboration with FX Fowl and Beyerblender Bell, and we did some with executive architects, some of the work we did entirely as executive architects. We worked with all the constituent organizations of Lincoln Center, and with Lincoln Center LCDP, which kind of connected all of the clients, and Lincoln Center has this unusual governance that where all the 12 constituent organizations have to agree unanimously on every decision in public space. We worked with the city task force. We worked with the site had historic sensitivity, so we had to work with historic preservationists and various advocacy groups. As you can see on the left, anyway, this can spread out to more and more things. But this is just a lead off to say that if we had known then what we got to know, we probably wouldn't have gotten ourselves into this.
Much of life is that way.
and definitely naivete played a huge role in our doing the project and actually gaining some success.
So I'd like to maybe not totally structure a conversation, but at least to allow one to meander between the two projects, between And that is the perfect slide to end on, because one of the questions I wrote, tons of questions, I couldn't figure out what order to put them in. I'm actually interested in the architecture of this book, what order does it have, et cetera, et cetera, was that I had never actually read an architectural book with a chart of accountability at the back. So where you turn to find the index, you find this chart. And so this already tells us that we're not in a in an architectural book that's anything like one we've had in our hands before, even in a period where the demise of the architectural book has often been imagined, and where we might expect even from your earlier practice that you would be giving us some kind of an incredible digital invention or an LED invention or some kind of installation in our own space rather than a radical transformation of the book that seems to be, you know, turned inside out. Just as, in a way, when you read this triumphant tale, you think, first of all, it's a story that, happily, you've done it at the end, so we know it all turns out well, because it had all the ingredients for disaster. And it's an absolutely extraordinary you know, a tale of diplomacy, of ins and outs, all sorts of evidence of what ended up on the cutting floors in this book. It's a really, in many ways, sort of sui generis. But it's also a book about something which you yourself admit you inherited as a defunct place. What was a 60s performing arts center? How has it been that New York had come to have one and that it was no longer working? So there's some kind of interesting synergy between producing one of the heaviest books on architecture produced in the last decade and having taken on the task of trying to turn a dinosaur into a piece of the city. So maybe I'd just like to hear a little bit. This is the behind story of the project, a little bit like the DVD that you get where you get the extras on the making of the film. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the making of the book and your thoughts about why it is you were motivated to want to make this book. What's the relationship between the book and the project? Mm-hmm. Would you have made this book for other projects? Would we have a second volume on Highline, for instance?
That's a good idea.
There are a lot of questions in there. Pick the one you like.
Well, I don't know if anyone wants to start on that. From my point of view, the Lincoln Center project was 10 years in the making. It was huge, far-reaching. It was transformational for our studio. It was a kind of maturing of the studio. There was so much complexity in it. It took so much sacrifice, and it's a project in our own city, which really changes the game. You can't just leave. You're always faced with, just the legacy of what was there and what you've left behind. And as patrons of the arts, we want to coming to our own space. So that it had a lot of personal significance for us to actually do the project. When the project was nearing completion, we were starting to feel, I think, a postpartum kind of situation. It was nearly 10 years. And we felt that there was so much. First of all, it's part of the problem of the geographical fixity of Lincoln Center, that it's here. If we made a project of Lincoln Center, it could be disseminated, and so it could transcend just the site. But it was also an opportunity for us to collect our thoughts, really, and reflect back on the project and the various stories of the project. And there were so many. And many, many of the stories will never be told because they're just so complex and no one would believe them anyway. That we thought that at least putting some of the stories forward, remembering some of the very, very interesting things that happened there and the intersections with people, the kind of pre- and post-occupancy conditions, the struggle to get unanimity, just internally we had so many ideas about any particular site. And so it's just an opportunity to put it in one place, and it will never be complete, but it had to be big, and it also had to be immersive.
Well, I kept trying to find.
Just, I just want to add a point that also in our studio, we put out another diary of a book, and that's Blur, The Making of Nothing. Mm-hmm. So I think we're interested in the documentation of our projects in a way that's very different than a traditional architecture book. And this clearly had all the parts and pieces of a melodrama, much like Blur did as well. So it seemed like a thread that we want to continue to explore in the studio.
Yeah, the thing that interests me, because I was racking my brain. I don't even know if we call it reading. We should talk about whether you actually read this book. If you haven't seen it yet, it's entirely made up of these gatefolds. So you could have the impression that you were looking at an absolutely exquisite coffee table book of a type of photography that mostly refuses to be formal. And then you discover that every one of them opens up into a incredibly designed spread. It slows you down. It's not a big go with you. It's about. But the interesting thing is there's so many things to be discovered in those folds. Mm-hmm. One of the books that I thought about, I was thinking, where else has somebody recounted a tale like this? And I thought Richard Meyer, Inside the Getty Center. That's a triumphal tale. That's where I take possession of what happened. Here is the official version, and the architect will. It doesn't have a chart of accountability at the end. So I want to hear about the architecture of this incredible design in relationship to what it is that you wanted to record, because it's not the obvious way to do it.
Yeah, but the book is 10 years of our life. You know, that's recorded and documented. I think for me what's incredible is that whenever we do a project and finish a project, I always have a frustration of going to the project and not having that experience of not knowing what it is and seeing it for the first time. It's like I prefer to go to movies without reading the review, simply to have the impact of what that is. So when I go up in the High Line, for example, I'm kind of envious of people who arrive there and see it for the first time not knowing what to expect. So the
because
book,
of course Rick only sees punch lists when he
yeah
when he
we
goes
always well we can't go we can't see an event at Lincoln Center without Liz calling them the next day saying those lights were out or that was need to be fixed. But there is something about when you do the book, you can revisit the project, and in some ways you see the project for the first time. You can step back and look at it and have a clearer understanding of what you did and what your involvement in the project was.
I want to also say something very directly to your question about the structure of the book. Everything that we do, we want to kind of reinvent it. You know, it's just like this pathology maybe that we have. But in this case, we wanted to actually make this book available to the general public. We didn't want to just have a book that is for a scholarly readership or students or, you know, any particular group. We wanted it to really be able to be seen in multiple ways. And the notion of making a kind of photographic book that you would put on your coffee table, and we call it like an architecture porno book, you know, which has like beautiful or full bleed photos, but then has the intricacy of the stories with a lot of text, with sketches, with references, and that really gets into the depth of what's behind those photos, what's inside of those spaces, and that was really, really important. That's where the serial gatefolds came from. So you can flip through the book and you could just see, and many people, you know, look at that book and they think it's just a photographic book, but you have to take your time actually and leaf through it. And it asks you to engage. Yeah.
But that's one of the most amazing things about it. Mine isn't old enough to know if with age it gets midriff bulge, but it's so tautly made that you actually can flip through and never be aware of the fact that these gatefolds are there. You have to discover them. And they're not announced in any way on the outside, and there's not a kind of organizational chart that can tell you what you can expect to find when you unfold one photo.
But this is very much when Elizabeth said, if we knew what we were going to get involved in, we probably wouldn't have gone ahead with the project. And in a way, the gatefold is exactly that. Everything looks beautiful, but then you open it up and discover all the problems and travails and angst that occurred to arrive at that cover photo. But it has to do very much with the essence of the project. And Blur, for example, the book is basically a book of all of the emails and newspaper clippings and problems, but it was all the emails that went back and forth as the project was done in Switzerland. And the project for us was really a project that was an email project. So that kind of captures the essence of each project.
I thought you were going to say, we wouldn't have done that book had we known how hard that book was going to be when we set out to do that book.
Well, this is where, you know, Alex, who has been collaborating with us, and it really is a piece of architecture, getting this thing right and getting it to flatten and getting it to hold together, because I don't think that a book of gatefolds has ever been done like this. So it was, to us it seemed, that's going to be easy, and it turned out to be very, very complicated, unfortunately. And also with Damiani, the book was done with tender, loving care, printed and put together.
But that does sound like Lincoln Center.
Well, that's the point. They're two parallel projects,
right.
Offset mm-hmm. by a few years.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I loved finding in it, because it doesn't really have a finding aid, as it were, so you do find all sorts of things. You don't know what you're going to get into, even for the reader, once you get into this book. But you open up some and you find accounts of amazing ideas that you had along the way, and you suddenly realize that you need to be Diderot and have the encyclopedia if you were going to account for all of the design ideas that went through in the studio and its various permutations during this nearly decade-long project. So I guess the question is, could you tell us something about the cutting floor? What do you decide mm-hmm. when you're going to go pick something back up mm-hmm. on the cutting floor? What happens to stuff on the cutting floor? You brought some of it back. How do you decide what goes into the book, what doesn't? Are those ideas retained because they still have potency and you're hoping to find a new home for them, or are they always going to be part of the story of Lincoln Center?
They found their home.
In the book.
But there was so much that didn't make it to the book.
Yeah.
Some of the things that didn't make it into a brick, bricks and mortar, are in there, and some of the things that didn't make it to there are still part of our brains, I think, and they will find a way out at some point. But I think maybe it has also a lot to do with our process. We tend to think in multiples. We don't see only one idea, one solution. We look at the complexity of things. We come up with multiple strategies. We then identify really what we feel might be the best. And in all of our dealings with Lincoln Center, we did kind of open up the territory a lot for discussion. And then in the end, counsel them toward the right solution. And I think nearly always, Lincoln Center was a great client and really listened. There were areas where we just couldn't get it right or couldn't find an alignment. And so aside from those things that we would naturally do, we struggled and struggled and struggled. And for example, the bridge across 65th Street was one of those examples that we did over 100 designs, couldn't quite get it right. And then, I think hopefully we got closer at the end. The fountain, which was probably the most sensitive location in Lincoln Center. It's the place where you say, I'm going to meet you at some place at Lincoln Center. It means the fountain. And so nobody really loved that fountain, but it was a location. And it was a very delicate matter. When we thought of new ideas about what to do with centering or what to do with a fountain that could be used actually for performance, that could go away, that could be a place of socializing that wasn't outwardly focused but inwardly focused. We had many ideas about how to take that location, really translate it. But in the end, we couldn't really convince anyone to go there because it was such a sensitive spot at Lincoln Center. And I think that for us, it ended up okay. because we also learned about that kind of the voice, how far to exert your voice, and maybe sometimes it's just sotto voce. And in that case of the fountain, it was really about tweaking the design of the fountain.
Yeah,
it wasn't about relocating it or changing it up.
I thought it was because Gene Wilder chased Zero Mostel around the fountain and the producers, and they just couldn't lose that iconic image. I'm not sure. But projects, they're all the things that end up as drawings or end up not being built, for us are as much projects as those that are built. They are completed. And, you know, they've had their life. We've done, and I think from when Elizabeth and I first started, we did a lot of instant projects. They were almost Polaroid snapshots. We built things. They were up for 2 weeks, and then they became New Jersey landfill or performance pieces or things that come and go. The Blur, which is kind of a famous club in Switzerland, was there for a brief period, and it's gone. So there's something very interesting for me about the both permanence and impermanence of ideas and thoughts in architecture.
When we went back and looked at our initial presentation, which took place 10 years ago, and we had these crazy ideas, like a giant moving umbrella that would be 250 feet by 250 feet square, and it would roll around, and we thought, oh, that's easy to do, to put a crane
there.
You had
forests that we were going to move around.
What's that?
You had forests that we were going to move around, too, or trees.
Yes, we had trees. And what's interesting is they were harebrained but fun ideas, and the thing that made them spark in the first place is still trickling through our thought process, either there or in new projects. But every project has its own DNA, and every project has its own demands, and we try not to repeat things. But there's certainly ideas that are exciting to us, and they morph, and they show up.
There's some crazy, incredibly crazy ideas in the presentation we made to the committee that was selecting an architect. We're still not quite sure why they selected us, for what reason they decided to go with us.
One word I think all three of you used was voice, which I think is interesting to ask in relationship to this book, which is, you know, whose voice is this book, and what are the other, of course, we know that your three voices are there, although we'd love to hear more about the conversations that happened between the three of you and then all the other people in the studio, which grew exponentially and changed enormously during this period. But there are other voices that are allowed into this book, almost as though, not sure if it's a chamber ensemble or an orchestra or an opera. I suppose if this book were music, what is it? But what would you say is the idea of the voice in this book, since each of you used in one way or another the word voice in the last in your thoughts?
No, I think the book is a DSNR book, right? And it is our voice, but we don't really speak in the first person when we tell these stories, you know, and it's told in a kind of semi-objective way, but of course it's not very objective. We do the accounts of the spaces, of the information that we think is relevant, of the interesting intricacies, and we tell it in a way that we feel is an interesting read. There are also some voices of the leadership of Lincoln Center, which are as well there, and the voices of several of the architects that also contributed to the overall plan, you know, in the end. So we didn't think that this really wanted to be so monolithic. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just kind of go back to what Rick had mentioned, that how unlikely it was that we got this project at all. When we were interviewed for it, we were interviewed among some very established firms, of which we were, I would say, risky characters. I'm not really sure how we made that list, but I think Rebecca Robertson had something to do with that. But in any case, we had nothing to lose, so we showed a bunch of things that we could imagine. Like Charles was saying, it's a big moving roof, and here's a landscape that moves, and the pool that was undermined that became a roof, and so forth. We had lots of ideas. The leadership at Lincoln Center was just not prepared, I think, to see anything like this. But, and I don't think that they imagined that anything that we showed it could, would actually be realized. But what I think that they saw in us was people who just dove in and had a kind of affection for this place that could envision how to take it the next step. Some of our competition didn't really, couldn't imagine that, you know, would prefer to have, you know, blown it apart. In our case, we just accepted that it was part of New York iconography, and it's okay, maybe that some of the architecture was not, at the time that it was built initially, it wasn't necessarily the architecture that you would say was ahead of its time. And it was very controversial. Ada Louise Huxtable had some very critical ideas about it and takes on it. But what we wanted to do was just kind of to step in there, and we felt that we could do justice to it, and we could also interpret it for contemporary culture. So 50 years later, half a century later.
One of the most intriguing things you said over and over again, I don't know whether it's the collective voice or somebody came up with this wonderful quip, and it's supposed to date back to these initial conversations, which is that you wanted to make Lincoln Center more Lincoln Center, so that the Lincoln right. Center at the end would be more than it was Lincoln Center at the beginning. Yeah. Which sounds practically Gertrude Stein.
I think that's the critical point, is that we didn't go in and say, these are the problems we want to correct. We simply said Lincoln Center, in a way, has to be finished. It's off to a good start, and we really like it, but we really have to bring it to completion. So it wasn't a matter of going in and with kind of its problems, somehow we'll find solutions, but let's take it to the next step of what it could be as a place.
But it's really kind of amazing when you think about before we arrived on the scene, It was thought of as very elitist, right, and very solid, and the plinth and the solid walls, and turning its back on the community, and there was so much criticism. It's not to say that the halls weren't filled with really interesting things and events, but it certainly didn't manifest itself in the public spaces or on the outer surfaces. And however, there was one place that we're very drawn to, and we continue to think that that is as relevant today when it was done, is the promenade level, Avery Fisher, the Metropolitan Opera, and New York State Theater, where everyone pours out an intermission overlooking the fountain, and you have this fantastic buzz in the middle of events. They really got that right. It was really it's kind of a beautiful thing. It feels very very contemporary still.
It's like Lincoln Center's highlight.
It is. It's super social, and it's a way of these buildings communicating with one another in space. And we thought, and that's, I think, what we meant, that to make Lincoln Center more, that's the part of Lincoln Center that we love, that we wanted to somehow extend out as much as we can throughout the whole site.
And I think, I mean, to your point, Rick, you said we completed it. I actually think we uncompleted it. You know, we sort of, it felt dead and done, and I think what we did is opened it up, and we made it fungible and supple, and it still continues to change and grow. There's a new piece by Hugh Hardy on the roof of the Lincoln Center Theater. They're probably going to renovate Avery Fisher. So there's new life, I think.
Yeah, we'll continue to grow. But it kind of touches on a larger problem, which is not just Lincoln Center, but really across the country, which is for Lincoln Center, their constituents were getting very old. They weren't bringing in a younger audience. There are questions about, do we really need large halls for performances or smaller pop-up, smaller venues, which bring in a younger audience and reintroduce them to classical and other forms of music, the way to go. So there's another kind of question buried in there in terms of Lincoln Center's future and how it has to continue to change.
I was going to say, maybe this is a really bad analogy, but just as I was struck reading this book, that you don't read it in order, and it's it is a kind of campus with multiple entry points, but it also slows you down and leads to discoveries. I think you've changed the time frame of Lincoln Center, not only that obviously you've changed the time frame from the 60s to the second decade of the 21st century, but you've also made it, it used to be a place that you went and you tried to get there not more than 5 minutes before the performance time, because what were you going to do if you were too early and then you left as soon as the curtain went down? And you have really, you've given it a daytime, you've given it the, you know, I go to Lincoln Center now at least an hour ahead of time because there are places to eat, there are things to do, you know, so you've actually completely transformed that. When I wasn't thinking that this was so much about the book, I wanted to ask you if you can even remember yourselves before Lincoln Center.
If you want.
But don't do it,
yeah. Can you remember yourselves before Lincoln Center?
I had long hair.
I think we were like 12, you know, now we're like in the like 80-something. Again, we were just, we thought we knew everything, and then we realized, I think, you know, one of the stories that I like to talk about when kind of reminiscing what it was like before, you know, a couple of years into Lincoln Center, it was that, you know, that famous adage or whatever that, you know, it's like 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. I was frustrated with all the meetings and all the complexity, and there was it was so much about a consensus building and so much about zillions of presentations and you know, all of that. And I think that at some place, maybe year 5 or 6, I kind of realized myself that the 99% is just as creative as the 1%, and to, you know, to get consensus, to be able to educate, to be able to kind of, you know, the sort of the give and take, the difficulties were really, really interesting. And I think that, you know, on the one hand, there's stuff out there, but on the other hand, there's like all these stories and there's growth. And I think a kind of understanding back and forth. And we never, I think with all of the constituent groups that we spoke to, and there were many, we spoke in a slightly different voice, but the message was always the same, but with just different tweaks.
Isn't there some story about you giving a PowerPoint in which you gave it in 12 different voices as though you were speaking to 12 different listeners or something like that?
In fact, yes, it was a lecture that that I wrote for at Columbia, that I did at Columbia, and it was Lincoln Center 6 Ways. And it was basically the same group of slides with the same explanation,
there were like 12 slides.
There were very few slides, and but just with very minor tweaks in between. So it was like a Rashomon, telling the story over and over again. But on the one hand, to the constituent organizations, the donors, the leadership, the city, because it was a very important project for the city. To the professional groups, to academic groups, to the press, to historic preservationists, and so forth. But it's still the same story. Nothing really changes. It's just a question of emphasis.
Do you think you guys have changed in 10 years? I think if I saw that before Lincoln Center, that would be, to my mind, in the let's say the installation projects, the gallery projects, that protean work that precedes Lincoln Center that made it such a so unlikely that you would be the one to redo it. Well, that chart would have been doing a very different function.
We have new coffee cups because of, and I remember this day when we had one of our clients from Lincoln Center over, and we had test tubes as coffee cups in the old days. And they had little spouts. They were glass, and they were really cool. And they had measuring units on the side. And I remember one of the early client meetings, the client turned over and came pouring out of the spout. And I think we all looked at each other and we said, "It's time to grow up."
Yeah, I refuse. But now I remember when we first, before we were interviewed and we were doing research in Lincoln Center, and we started looking for photographs of the Lincoln Center, the only photographs you found, the public photographs, were always in Josie Robertson Plaza, either in front of the fountain. The majority of them were in front of the Metropolitan Opera. And there were no photographs of any other place. And like I said, the North Plaza, Henry Moore never got a photograph taken with anybody in it. And I remember that there was one point when we wanted to remove the Dan Kiley trees because it wasn't the way he designed it any longer. It couldn't support his design. And we wanted to open up for the public. And Liz was doing the presentation, and the objection was, you know, that they had to keep it the way it was. And Liz talked about bringing life back into the plaza. And they said, well, you know, this is a 60s plaza. And in the 60s, plazas were designed to be rather desolate. And I suddenly had visions of, you know, Antonioni movie with Monica Vitti in the corner. And pieces of paper blowing across the plaza, right? And it was just such a beautiful image. And I think Elizabeth almost gave in at the point to saying, leave it as it is.
Well, 60s architecture doesn't have that many advocates. So we found ourselves on both sides of the, you know, of the argument. On the one hand, the Dan Kiley landscape was very beautiful when it was designed. And as Rick says, it went through time. There was so much transformation at Lincoln Center. The trees died. The planters weren't big enough. There were just many, many problems. And we were struggling between contemporary programs. Like, you know, what Lincoln Center really needed was a place of congregation where many people could sit, maybe in the shade, and there could be a performance. And so we're trying to figure out how to interpret Dan Kiley, how to work kind of in the spirit of Dan Kiley. And the same thing with the Belusky, Catalano, and, you know, with kind of the general feel of Lincoln Center, how to work with that DNA, but kind of really transform it for the logic of our time, you know. And that's the best idea about preservation, is not to eliminate it, not to allow people to destroy it, but just to kind of to continue to reshape it and tweak it, that was really a struggle with the historic preservation argument that some spaces were designed to be desolate, and we were asked to actually populate it, and our struggle was that Lincoln Center ostensibly had always talked about putting public events in their public spaces, and they were not able to do that. So it was really about culture being in public space.
Remember, we also had this moment where we tried to even make it more austere, and we proposed for the few hours one day, covering all of 65th Street with the extension of the plaza. And in a way, I think we were a little, you know, the World
That's
Trade
Center. That's not in here, right?
It's not
I don't think
there.
It made it through.
That, I said it was a few hours.
Well, that's the gatefold that won't open.
No, but I mean, you know.
Had to last for a couple of days to be in there.
By that time, you know, the World Trade Center was no more. There was not a mega block in New York City. And we were concerned in a way that we were, you know, there was the demise of this really amazing architectural gesture from the 60s, whether it made great cities or not, it was a specimen.
Don't worry, there's a really great, terrible one still up at Columbia.
Oh, yeah,
University,
Columbia.
In the law school.
Oh, well, that's true. That's so true. Well, we'll send that sketch over, two-hour sketch over. Anyway, so, yeah, I mean.
But that preservation thing is interesting. I'm thinking, remembering your retrospective, which now seems like ancient history, but it was probably a little over 10 years ago at the Whitney. Mm-hmm. And who could have predicted at that moment, which was a kind of really vital transition moment, that today we'd be sitting here and between Lincoln Center and the High Line, your firm is not only one of the most creative repopulators of preserved, difficult preserved objects, but also probably produced more successful urban space for New York City than any other set of designers. So, you know, you kind of, in a way, are
are shaping this moment and what it means to be an outdoor public space in New York City.
Barry, you know, the one thing I have to say is that I think we were at the right place at the right time with the right administration. You know, because if that had not been the Bloomberg administration, I think that these projects probably would not have taken off the way they did. So the administration put a big, you know, emphasis on public space culture, and then there were, you know, the citizen activists like the Friends of the High Line. And I think that, you know, maybe it was we were the beneficiaries of having like a lot of great leadership around these projects, also Ren Levy and all the people around Lincoln Center. These were really great clients, and you know, sometimes we really worry, you know, as the clock ticks down, you know, whether and you know, hopefully we will be able to continue, and Europe will continue to get better and better. But we really see ourselves as like in being incredibly privileged to be able to do these things that we can also now enjoy.
I want to just say thank you for that compliment, yeah. But I think there are other designers around that would perhaps disagree. But to add to what you said, a lot of boats have risen with this tide, and there's been a lot of great public work all over the city made, and we're very fortunate about that.
Yeah, I'm talking quantity and visibility.
Okay.
You know,
I'm just trying to be PC.
Your humbleness is nice, but within an incredibly short period of time, and you certainly are, I mean, I'm sure there's a diagram not quite as complicated as that for the High Line, but within an incredibly short period of time, the High Line has become, along with the Metropolitan Museum of Art, another museum, one of the top places where you have to go the minute you get off the airplane, out of your car, the train, wherever. And that's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I guess before we open it up to people who are here to ask about the book or the buildings, I'm just wondering, but maybe you don't want to say or maybe you don't know yet, what would be the book for the High Line?
We haven't done the book because we're not sure yet what that is.
Maybe it would be like a sausage, you know, like with lots of links and, you know, infinitely expandable.
An accordion.
I think it would be an accordion book that when you open it up would go the entire length of the line. And when you put it back together, it would stack, you know, who knows how high.
I did see an amazing...
Halfway to the moon, I think, is what they said in grade school.
I saw an amazing thing in the Avery Library the other day, which is a souvenir book on the St. Louis World's Fair of 1904, which is an accordion, miniature accordion, that folds back into a walnut.
Oh. Nice.
So, wow.
Yeah. Nice.
I think this belongs in this history of...
Let's have a meeting tomorrow.
Book Should we open it up to the questions from the audience?
This is a perfect time to open up to questions from the audience. And the program's being audio recorded, so I'm going to pass around the microphone so your questions will also be recorded.
Here. Thank you so much. I'd be very keen to hear your opinion about the 78 blocks that are being rezoned in Midtown and how you would create an experience and life on the street to continue your work.
Which box?
I'll jump in by saying that we are actually thinking about the area around Penn Station as part of the Municipal Art Society's exploration, and so stay tuned.
But you're talking about the Grand Central.
I understand. Well, somebody else can talk about that one in particular, but we have an opportunity to start thinking about some of the areas of New York that are super dense and actually not working their best, So we're exploring that a little bit.
There's something very weird about us on the West Side. I actually don't really understand it, but you know,
we crossed the barrier.
Not
yet.
We did. We went north, but you know,
we're on the West Side of Fifth Avenue. Don't worry.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we never approach projects with a preconceived notion. It's a kind of if something comes in, we agonize over it and talk about it and think about it, and it's not a matter of pulling out the drawer and taking out an idea and dropping it down. So it would be something we'd have to really be open to and look at before.
I'm
not in the snap judgments.
I'm just one thing about scale and density. We are for the first time working on a tower, on a residential tower, and we've never done that. And we're doing it in, not in that location, but in Hudson Yards. And it is, we've kind of been at arm's distance from commercial projects, but we, we are doing, we're working on the Culture Shed with David Rockwell, and it's a big project for us. And as we are looking at that project, we're also looking at the adjacent property, and we're also looking at the High Line, at the ensemble of elements where an architect actually can, be able to exert some kind of set of interfaces, not just on one piece of property, but multiple properties that are adjacent and different programs.
And I would say, just to add, I think we all really like density in general. That's one of the reasons we've lived in this city and love it so much.
Life on the street, and what you did at the High Line, what you've done at Lincoln Center, is create that openness. So I'm really, the conversation is about the public realm that hasn't been brought forth as the city is doing this rezoning. And I think we as New Yorkers need to think about that public realm. Density is great. You get more green stuff if you have density, but it has to be thoughtful. You've been very thoughtful.
Right.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. I wanted to ask if, because it sounds like such a long process of elimination that went on, and almost as if elimination was so much a part of shaping it. And I wanted to ask, given that you had to get agreement by consensus and that chart, were you more surprised by what didn't go through than what did go through in the end, is my question. And then my comment is that as a total layperson, I think you deserve that compliment that was given, and that I wanted to let you know something about. They say that there's a saying that luck is where preparedness meets opportunity, and it certainly seems like that was the case here. So, but back to the original question about what got eliminated and what didn't and what surprised you more.
What got eliminated and what made it through, and if, you know, what surprised us in that process.
Which project?
In Lincoln Center. Mm. I don't know, just thinking back, I think that there was nothing really surprising. We were very provocative at the beginning of each of those projects, and then kind of worked our way toward realizing it, and it's always very complicated in architecture. I would say one thing that made it, that I'm really surprised that made it, was our desire to make blushing walls
in
Tully Hall. And this was just a lame brain idea. We wanted to make the architecture perform just like and have its moment in the limelight. And for that moment when the house lights came down, the something that took over, some kind of biological effect, of the blushing walls, and Lincoln Center, stood by us. It was totally crazy, and that's actually one of the good stories in the book, how we had this kind of goofy idea, and then we realized, oh my God, this is really complicated to do. How are we going to do it? What are the materials? What's the technology? How do you make the effect really work?
And I remember visiting mock-ups with you when you were working on it.
Yeah, and we had a full-scale mock-up, and then we did mock-ups in Utah.
I think the archaeology of the existing place was surprising at times, like finding a full-blown gas station in the parking garage under the Metro, opera, and finding that there wasn't that in order to save money when it was built, there were some very strange measures that were taken. They had an enormous number of problems. In fact, probably half of the cost of when they announced what it cost went into removing code violations, taking care of problems that hadn't been taken care of for years at Lincoln Center. So that was, I think, for me, surprising every time you turn the corner, discovered you couldn't build on Juilliard because they didn't put the bracing, lateral bracing in, so you couldn't sustain anything built on the roof. The fact that if there's a fire in Avery Fisher, it was going to exhaust all the smoke into the garage rather than outdoors. It's just one thing after another that we had to deal with.
When we did the archaeology, we found a river underneath Juilliard. There's literally a flowing river and a waterfall. And so we thought we would make a little tourist attraction and put, you know, like, for New Yorkers who want a little vacation. They didn't go for that. So that's one of the things that got cut. I'm joking. But there is a river underneath Juilliard.
Phantom of the Opera. There's a river under the Paris Opera.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
What did you learn about Wallace Harrison and Philip Johnson and Gordon Bunshaft by doing this this project? Were there certain things that you appreciated that they did, that you saw in a different light, other things that, you know, made you go, oh, my God, what the hell were they thinking?
Well, there is no, like, definitive book. There's some material that we tried to dive into. Architects are still alive that were involved in the process, and we tried to talk to as many people as we could. We went to the archives and found testimonials and discussions. And I think one of the things that you begin to understand when you dig into the history of the place was how disparate the whole effort was. Each of the architects was selected by an organization. They were trying to collaborate together. There was Johnson found himself in the middle, kind of unlikely, but in the middle. There were architects that were in at the beginning that got ousted because the tendency was drifting towards like what we would call postmodernism. At the time, it was like a retreat away from modernism. And there were very, very interesting issues that were put on the table. There was a lot of pressure. Moses, you know, and the whole political situation, Rockefeller, there was a lot of pressure. But I would say that one of the, like, most interesting things on reflection on this whole project was that what I think, and Rick sometimes tells the story, he was really, when Lincoln Center was being concocted, he thought it was a terrible idea to centralize the arts in one location. And now, you know, when we think about distributing culture as, you know, dispersing it as much as possible, but that notion of centralization, when we reflect back now, was a brilliant idea. I mean, and it's very unusual. Lincoln Center was in such a leadership position to have done this and to have made a campus. Whether they actually made use of the fact that they had a campus and had enough interaction, like, I don't think so. There was artistic connections, but it really didn't feel like a campus. But it was a very novel thing at the time to do, and now we call it synergy, you know, that these places are together. And there was some really interesting foresight.
Although it always seemed that there should be a synergy of the intermission times in all three theaters or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, sure. We really would all come out and see everybody out there.
Well, now with social media, you can be like, meet me at the fountain.
I think that synergy is a good point to in this absolutely most fascinating program. But I can't help but ask the last question. And, you know, many of us experience sound through architecture and motion. And how prominent was the concept of sound when you were working on the redevelopment of Lincoln Center?
Good question.
I would say there was a kind of drifting in and out of consciousness, certainly in Josie Robertson Plaza. One of the strategies was the fountain itself produced a kind of white noise, and we wanted to amplify that white noise to be actually spatial, and that was one of our ideas about the fountain. Once you get to North Plaza, it's really a different atmosphere. When we got into Town Hall, it was very specific as the first time, and also Juilliard, to be thinking about shaping sound and shaping space for the musicians and for the audience. So it was extremely prominent at that point, but it was kind of drifting in and out of the project.
But there are buildings built. When I think of sound and Lincoln Center, I think of Jacques Tati and his films were, you know, modern contemporary architecture made sound. It was the squeak of your shoes on the floor.
Absolutely, playtime. And I really appreciate your comments and references to films throughout this program.
So I think very much aware of people who are going there, who are going to listen to music, who should be attuned to the noises of architecture and the sounds of architecture. I think it was important for us. And actually, it was absolutely frightening in terms of doing Tully Hall, which was interesting because it had a dead center in the hall. They always set the critics on the edges because it was a kind of a gutter ball hall. All the sound came down along the edges. The critics thought they were being given those seats so they could get out before the crowd to write their, you know, glowing reviews. But it was very interesting. But our concern was, okay, we're redoing a hall, and everybody's going to sit there and say, is it better, is it not better? So sound is really kind of at the forefront of your thinking, working on
Before some people depart here, I just want to acknowledge Kate Levin, who is just leaving.
Oh, my God, she's sneaking out.
And those folks really, paved the way for a project like this and also Lincoln Center Culture Shed and many other projects around the city have to be thankful for leadership. I mean, and Barry, your leadership, and, you know, that it's a really interesting situation where our generation is kind of coming into leadership positions, so we can't exactly critique, you know, the institution. We're now like part of it, and we speak in its voice, and that's a little scary, but somehow there's an alignment.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right? That goes back to the voice issue. Right? Speaking of sound. Okay.
Well, thank you so much for this most brilliant discussion.